form is variable that you don't need.
Right. And it actually doesn't turn out to be that big cutting into the problem, but it's still far from obvious.
There's double the number of bits in the whole area, so there's got to be. You're doubling it because you're multiplying by two going this way, and when you calculate how many bits there are.
Yeah, so look at the bottom row, say, mm-hmm. right? And every other thing in the bit, and you go for a distance 2x. So if going up a column here, you get b bits, you're going to get 2b bits going across there.
Right.
So that's correct. The number of bits in that first bottom row is 2b. Sure. We stared at it for about 15 minutes and then finally resorted to desperate measures. So, yeah, take all the time you want to think about it. One of those formulas has to be false. Anyway, I'm making it easy for you. I'm telling you which one's right. You intuited where it looked.
There shouldn't be a 2 on the left-hand side of the lower one.
So if I leave off that 2, there's no 2 here. Means there's no 4 here.
Oh,
no,
that would be
then multiplied.
It
would be root 2. They're pondering. Juan was there when we worked it out this morning. Is the number of bits in one column. How many columns are there?
Oh, sorry.
No.
B is the number of bits in one column. There are 4 B columns.
Yeah. B is half the number of gums. Right? Or this way, 2B is half the number of gums. Right? So you've divided out the barriers twice. So we always knew it was fine from factors of 2 that made calculations difficult, but who knew that it was square root of 2? Give that to your students in your class. Don't tell them the answer. Let them puzzle over it. Have you guys seen the one with the exponential? Here's another one. Okay. Puzzle bag. Alright, so, let's see. Suppose we want to raise x to the y power. Right. That's equal to e to the y log x. That's equal to, let me write this as e to the 2 pi I y log x over 2 pi I. And I can write that as e to the 2 pi I to the y log x over 2 pi I. But e to the 2 pi I is 1 to the y log x over 2 pi I. And 1 to any power is 1. So x to the y is 1 for all x and all y. I won't say anything into this. You guys can puzzle on that one. Feel free to take notes.
E to the 2 pi I is 1. X to the y is always 1.
So x to the y is always 1.
Oh.
For every x and every y. It's probably false somewhere. what has gone wrong? Okay, then let's see. What else have we got here? Want to grade some quantum papers? No. Let's see. Standard model. Going back to okay. I'll let you think about this a little bit.
What is it seeking?
What is that? What?
What is the question?
What's the question? We suspect that there's some error here because x to the y is probably not 1. Where's the problem? So there's some error in the logic. What is it? Well, I can see you guys are going to be just interested in the afternoon. Any questions on anything we've been talking about? Let's see.
That's a multivariate function.
Very good. What?
The log.
The log, yeah. Log of multivariate. Good. You're on the right track. You're on the right track.
So you have to add 2 pi.
Where?
You have log x.
Here?
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
To the y. X to the y.
X to the y?
Yes, yes.
Is e to the y log x. That's right.
Log x exponent y.
No, it's time.
Well, now you have to make it.
Make it. Yeah, that is certainly equal to e to the log x to the y.
Right.
That's how I got there in the first place.
Right, right.
And then that's 2 pi.
What's 2 pi?
The value.
Where? What's multi-value here?
2 pi r.
Well, log goes from 0 to like...
X and y are real. X and y are real positive. Full district. So, a lot of real numbers you need.
These things have different like ranges, though. You know, like log, you know, the real is real. I think it's just like from 0 to infinity, right? You know, whereas if you're changing the domains of these things, you know, like this. One. Well, no. It doesn't make a difference, but.
Yeah, maybe it only works for, say, positive frequency here. You're thinking along the right line. But a lot of the steps here are correct. So, yeah. Finding exactly where the problem comes.
Let's see, there's another matrix.
There is a factor of 2 missing in the thing interaction, you know?
Yes, forgot the LS coupling. Exactly. That would have brought it right back down to Earth. Good. Okay. Problem solved. We forgot the spin orbit coupling. I'll just send out your Friday. Maybe. Pretty much. Okay, and there's another one that... Oh, what's the name? Pontecorvo and three other people. I forget the names now. It's in the notes, which I haven't posted the revised notes yet. I did post some revised notes, but they don't have this in it yet. But yeah, we're pretty close to the end of the standard model here, at the beginning of the standard model. So, we'll write down an action that does the basic standard model stuff. But when it comes to testing the standard model, then you want to take an action like the one that Joe showed us, where you really flesh it out with all possible terms that you haven't tested, and test it to see if those terms actually occur or not. So, we don't necessarily know whether gluon interaction will preserve parity. It's hard enough to study the strong interaction as it is. So, M-A-S-K-A-W-A. Lots of A's. Like banana. Only Japanese. Maskawa. And yeah, I'm sorry, I don't remember. One of these is the kata. and I suspect it was a couple of staccato, though I'm not sure. I forget the other names here. Pontecorvo, back in the 60s, suggested the possibility of neutrino oscillation. It was first measured by Davis and Bacall in around 1970, somewhere in the early 70s, I think. They set up the first big neutrino detector, which was a 500,000-gallon tank of cleaning fluid, carbon tetrachloride. And you know the experiment? What could happen is the occasional neutrino would do an inverse beta decay with the chlorine atom. Carbon tetrachloride, you've got four chlorine, lots of chlorine in this tank. And chlorine, if it absorbs the neutrino, can turn into argon. And argon, being extremely stable, can be detected. So they would pump this through and do a sort of this 500,000 gallon tank to find single argon atoms. And they could detect, you know, better than 50% of the argon atoms they'd find. In the course of the first year of running this thing, I think they found 6 or 7 argon atoms.
Maki and Nakagawa.
You got it? Ah, good. Okay, thank you. What are you looking at?
Oh, just Wikipedia. Maki. Nakagawa. Sakata,
right?
Yep, just Japanese view.
Okay, so we got them right, and that's another name. So we'll talk about those matrices today. So Pontecorvo predicted the neutrino mixing that Bacall and Davis actually saw. And that did not fit with the standard model.
How do they detect the argon atoms?
Yeah, I'm
not sure. You could use the mass spec, but that's, you know, and you want to recycle this stuff. So I don't actually know what they did.
Doesn't it float up in a way and it's easy to collect in bubbles?
These
must have 7 argon.
6 atoms per year.
Out of a 500,000 gallon tank?
Yeah.
6 or 7 atoms?
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah. It's boggling. I don't know what they're talking about. They could demonstrate that, you know, alright, so here's how you might test it, you know, put a known amount of argon in, you know, some known amount of chlorine and dilute it down until you're looking at, you know, parts per 10 to the whatever. Inject that into the tank and test whether you can detect, you know, what proportion of that you can detect. Well, the point of the experiment was that the neutrinos produced in the light fusion in the center of the sun, which make up the predominance of neutrinos happening through here now, are created as electron neutrinos. It's a process of nuclear fusion that, you know, produces neutrons, the neutrons decay. There are neutrinos given off, and they're electron neutrinos. So given that you're producing these huge numbers of electron neutrinos, if the standard model in its simplest form holds, then they arrive at Earth as electron neutrinos. But the numbers that Davis and Bacall were seeing were about a third of the predicted number of solar neutrinos. So either the solar models of thermonuclear production were off, or their cross-sections for chlorine capture of neutrinos were off. I was involved in an experiment to check that cross-section, actually. We looked at the inverse process where, let's see, what was it? It was like a radioactive chlorine would decay into argon, but it shouldn't have the related cross-section. So we were bombarding protons on the signal method.
Proton delaying data emission?
We had a chlorine target and bombarded it with a proton beam at the Michigan State cyclotron. We're testing the cross section for the the absorption, the capture of the neutrinos. Anyway, the parameters checked out, and you know, subsequent 40 years of experiment have confirmed that we see about a third. Well, and what's happening is the electron neutrinos are turning into muon neutrinos and tau neutrinos. You get neutrino oscillations, which can only happen if you have different energy for the different neutrino states. If there's a mass difference, so say the electron neutrino could be massless, but the muon neutrino could have a small mass, then you could get oscillations. What happens is you have you need different energy states. So if you've got the electron neutrino as one state and the tau, or say the mu neutrino as another state, and you look at the time evolution of these states, if you've got an E1t here and an E2t there, minus I over h bar E2t, then you can write that state as an overall phase. That doesn't do anything. But now you have your neutrino plus e to the I over h bar energy difference. So, all right, the energy is just going to be the mass energy of the neutrino. So if they're massless, that's zero. But new mu. So at you get an oscillation going with frequency energy difference over h bar, and so a system that starts out as pure electron neutrino will oscillate back and forth. You basically have a double well potential with the barrier. So something that starts out over here is going to tunnel through, and eventually you'll build it up here. It just flashes backwards, back and forth, with this frequency. Well, let's see. Let's solve the problem. What does that frequency have to be in order to observe good mixing from the sun? You know, let's figure out what the lightest neutrino mass could be. Anybody happy with this?
Okay.
All right, so if this is like, you know, suppose one is massless and the other is massless, so we'll have a mass for the, say, the muon neutrino. This frequency has to be large compared to the flight travel time from the sun. So, what's the light travel time from the sun?
7 minutes.
7 minutes. You probably know more accurately than me. You've been looking at these orbits, right? So, 7 or 8 minutes per second, 500 seconds or something.
Is it
m
squared or
is
it mc squared?
Oh, mc squared. Thanks. So it's got to be much greater than 1 every 500 seconds, right? So it's got to be... that right? Yeah, if it oscillated one sun away from the sun, that would be the cycle. Yeah, one cycle for 500 seconds would be 1/500 Hertz. So we want a frequency that's much larger than that, so that there's plenty of time, because the result was actually a third the number predicted. So all three are oscillating into one another. So presumably the muon neutrino mass differs. This is actually the difference between the masses. But let's suppose, just to keep it simple, let's suppose that the electron neutrino is massless. It could have a mass on the order of a few electron volts, actually, but let's see what this predicts. So we need this much greater than, let's see, what is that, 0.2 times 10 to the student one. That's minus 2. So 2 times 10 to the minus 3. Times Planck's constant. What's Planck's constant?
6.63 times 10 to the minus 34.
The H or H bar?
We want H bar.
Oh, well, divided by 2 pi.
H of P about 1.
5.
1.6, yeah, that sounds right.
Is there another 2 pi there because we're dealing with omega? Or is it after 2 pi?
It's there because we're dealing with omega.
Okay.
And then we need 10 to the 8 squared is 10 to the 16th. 1.06, right?
Yep.
So that's 1. Okay. This is approximate. So we have 18 times 10 to the minus 37 minus 21. So that's 1.8 times 10 to the minus 20. What is that, children? What is that in EV? Or 1.6 times 10 to the minus 19 EV. Let's see. What do we need? What do we want? We probably want the energy, right? Hang on.
Let's
try this again. MC squared. Let's leave the C in there. Right. So MC squared is on the order of H bar times that. Oh, yeah, we probably want this in angular frequency, though, don't we? 2 pi to 1. Let's see. No. Okay. On the order of. Let's see. Frequency is 2 pi omega. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
So I want this over 2 pi, because I want that to be omega, right? So H bar omega is about equal to 1 over pi times 10 to the minus 3rd times 10 to the minus 34 is 10 to the minus 7, 37. And that's joules, right? So we divide that by 10 to the minus 19, and that's really small. Is that right? No, it's like lots. No, very few. It's almost no EV. 10 to the minus 18 EV.
Oh.
That doesn't seem right. Well, Christian one is a lot bigger than that. That's really, really small. Is that right?
I mean,
order of magnitude, but, yeah.
You know it's like 0.4, 4, and 40 or something, right?
Well, there are much better estimates
yeah.
than that. Now, this is just a lower limit, but
right.
the important thing here is that difference is not zero. So one of these things has to have some mass. The actual limits currently on the masses are, yeah, the electron neutrino less than 5 or 10 eV,
yeah.
something 4.4, is that what it is?
Yeah.
And the muon neutrino, what, less than 40 EV? Is that what you said?
I think so.
Yeah, the tau, the limits on the tau are not good at all. It should be much higher.
Yeah.
But even a small mass is plenty to produce the oscillations from the sun. So they would be thoroughly mixed by the time it got here from the sun. In fact, before they got out of the sun, it looks like they'd be thoroughly mixed.
Is that for anything?
What's that?
F.
What about F?
Seems to me that 2 pi F equals to
That is backwards, isn't that?
Yeah.
So I should be multiplying by 2 pi here. So, 6 to 12. So there's another 10 here. So, what's that? So, 37, 36. So, 17. It's got 10 times the 6. Small. Okay, and this is easy. So that's really tiny. I mean, that's actually much, much larger than the limits on the mass of the photon. The photon mass, I think, has to be something like 10 to the minus 30 or some, you know, enormously small thing to agree with various experiments, like the way the atmosphere acts as a some kind of a wave cavity. If you read in Jackson, he talks about the limits on the photon mass. And, you know, some very, you know, back of the envelope calculations can put some extremely good limits on how...
Jackson, Captain, what?
I think in the introduction he talks about it. You know, there are extremely good limits on the mass of the photon. So, alright. How's this relevant? What it means is neutrinos probably have mass. And those neutrinos that we put into the standard model so far don't have mass. So, what needs to be the case is that, alright, we can add a Yukawa type potential to give masses to the neutrinos. No, that's fine. Okay, three more parameters in the model, but all right, there we are. We'll go measure them and things are fine. Yeah.
Why are they produced?
What's the solar? You have several thermonuclear processes going on in the sun. Basically, you've got hydrogen fusing to produce. You get a diproton, right? Two protons, but that's not stable, they're just colliding. But what happens then is one of the protons will decay weakly. So it's going to emit a W plus, and that W plus is going to give an anti-neutrino, an anti-electron neutrino, and an anti-electron, a positron, and an electron neutrino, so that this thing proceeds as a deuteron, which is a stable system. That's the first interaction. Then you can have deuterons, you can have this turn into tritium with another collision, and eventually you keep adding protons and you come out with helium. So, Alpha
particles.
Alpha. Yeah. Right. And alpha particles. And then there are plenty of electrons around it. So the electrons will neutralize these and give up photons. But probably each stage of this, you end up emitting some electron neutrino. So this is the type of interaction you'd expect to see there. And people know the cross sections for these since they bomb. And so these processes are actually very well understood. You know, the probability for these various things and the amount of energy released and, you know, all of that is really very well understood at this point. So people have a lot of confidence in saying that you've got this big ball of hydrogen, the center is at a temperature of tens of millions of degrees, and this is going to happen. And it accounts for the age of the sun and the age of the planets and all of that stuff. So, you know, everything hangs together pretty well. A lot of energy comes off. The big difference between, okay, this electron is going to annihilate the positron will annihilate some electron and give off photons. And that's the light you see from the sun, but this occurs in the center of the sun. And the sun is at such high energy that the electron just picks up all the atoms. And so there are a lot of charged particles around it, like the early universe before recombination. So those photons scatter constantly. It takes a photon produced in the center of the sun about a million years to percolate to the surface. It's a very slow progress because it scatters so often. The neutrinos, bam, they're out. They're irradiating it. It's heaven mass. The neutrinos don't interact with anything. They, you know, the the difference in the number of detections that a neutrino detector gets on the at night and in the day, you know, they've been running these neutrino detectors now for 40 years. They've got a lot of statistics. There's no difference in the neutrino detection rate at night and in the day, which means that the neutrinos, the number of neutrinos is not decreased by passing through the Earth. if they interacted, we'd know it. There are 100 million neutrinos per second passing through my thumbnail right now. That's how high the flux of neutrinos is from the sun. I mean, if I aim my thumbnail towards where the sun is. There's a huge neutrino flux.
I mean, if you think about it, if every one of these reactions, the positron annihilates and produces the photons, then there's just as many photons as there are.
There's just as many neutrinos as there are photons.
Yeah, yeah, right. And yeah, we see lots of photons. Yeah. They don't look straight at them. So, yeah, it's a good thing they don't interact. Does that follow if an atom were to absorb a photon and bring it up to a different layer and then emit the photon, it can emit a higher energy photon?
It'll probably be a lower energy photon.
It'll either drop right back down where it came from or it'll hit some intermediate state. So, it might split and emit two lower energy photons. But
it wouldn't necessarily be a one.
Well, okay, it can happen either way. Because, if two photons are absorbed by an atom before it has a chance to emit, then it could emit a higher energy photon. You also get a Doppler shift. So, if a photon is absorbed, the atom collides and now moves in your direction and emits even the same frequency, is Doppler shifted to a higher frequency. You could get that kind of thing happening. Mostly that leads to a spreading of lines because it's just a probable decrease. But, on average, you'd probably get the same photon out that went in. They just put the time delay. So, the number of photons we're seeing is the number of neutrinos we would have seen a million years ago, but that hasn't changed much. Short amount of time in the lifetime of a star. Assuming, I'm writing the right interactions here and so on, there's some pretty close to one-to-one counting that goes on. The positron electron annihilation, there's probably enough around to soak up the extra momentum. You might want to produce two photons.
Right.
So, it's a 2-to-1, some simple ratio. Certainly the same order of magnitude, yes. That's right. Yeah. Kind of fun to puzzle through all this. It's amazing how much you can figure out if you ponder a while. We could probably figure out the whole set of reactions here. It's got to be a weak decay, right? You basically need to get rid of a bunch of protons in favor of neutrons. So you want to turn half the protons into neutrons. Well, you need a lot of energy to do that, but it's going to be a weak decay because the proton is. Because that's how you put the isotope.
Is anybody in that class for terrestrial?
That's probably a good course on this sort of thing from people who have actually studied this subject. Okay. So there's lots known about that. We need to give masses to the neutrinos. Very probably, unless there's just some other mechanism at work that's totally unexpected. And the Kobayashi-Moskawa matrix is the generalization of something Kadiba did. Did we talk about this before? I think I have said something about it before, but let me talk about the Kadiba angle once again, because we haven't talked about this in a couple of weeks, and so let me at least remind you of how that goes. We have isospin doublets for the quarks, the charm and stranger quarks and the top and bottom quarks, and the interaction that we've written in the standard model is covariance slash, let's see, what are we talking about here? This is the, we're interested in the weak interaction. We've got a psi bar, B slash psi terms for our fermion. Something like this occurs where, let's talk about the quarks. So we want to sum this over quarks. And this leads to an interaction. If we write this out, we've got psi bar for a given quark, there's a gamma mu, and then we have a covariant derivative, which, all right, I don't know what coefficients we're using at this point. Let's try an I and some coupling constant g. Let's see, then we're going to have, well, strong interactions, of course. The strong interactions, what do we call them? What did we name the gluon field? Anybody remember? B was the weak, yeah. Do I just call them G?
I think it was just G.
Mu, A. So, generators for SU3. So, these will be the gluons. And these are SU3 generators. So, A equals 1 to A. Then we're going to have, let's see, call that G strong. Then we have a G weak, that one we did just call G. And these are B, I, U. Here we go. So then we get the weak generators. These are SU2 generators. And, or what we call them, top. Okay, some of this is coming back. Then there was the single U1 generator. So SU3, SU2, U1. And all of these things are acting on our multiplex, our quark multiplex. So what's happening here, the weak interaction so far looks like some quark bar, a gamma mu, we've got a minus I, G, Bi, and U. Okay, so let me just look at this one term. So the SU2 fields from the weak. So the W's and some combination of the B and the photon. Well, what happens here is this tau mixes the up and down quarks. It mixes the charm and strange quark, and it mixes the top and bottom. But it does not give an interaction between, say, a strange quark and an up quark. So, this implies decay of the form. Suppose we have two downs and an up, that can decay with the emission of, say, a W minus to the down. The down can go to an up, so a neutron can weakly decay into a proton. Fine, no problem. But once strangeness is seen, it can be the case that, say, a sigma plus decays into a proton. All right, well, what's a sigma plus? Sigma plus is a strange particle. Okay, it's one row down in the octet from the neutron. So what we've done is we've changed one of the, what would we have? That would be like an up-up strange, and this would be an up-up down. So we're having a strange part turn into a down part, something like that. Could be a more likely it's a strange turning into an up quark, actually. The W should carry some isospins, I think, so it should change the S to a U probably rather than a D. But the point is that a strange particle, a particle with non-zero strangeness is conserved by the strong interaction. So strong interaction things are changing the color of the quarks, but they're not changing one quark type into another quark type. The weak interactions do. So that's why a neutron can decay weakly. But the sigma plus can actually eventually decay into a proton. And it'll always be a baryon. We need to conserve baryon number. But strange decays into ordinary protons and neutrons burst are pretty quickly. How can this happen? It can happen. You can think of it a couple of ways. And Kabibo, recognizing this, oh, probably in the
50s,
I forget when Kabibo was doing this, but fairly early on, the strange particles were known pretty early. I think the kaon, what did we say, mid-30s? I think the kaon was seen that early. So, what Kabibo did was to say that when we have, let's take a doublet. Let's look at this term. So what we have is minus I, G, then we've got, an up bar, down bar, and that's coupled with a BI / mu tau I. And this tau I can mix the up and down components, but what he supposed was that what was happening here was, actually, he would have had a singlet here because the charm part hadn't been conjectured yet, but he said, let's let this be a D prime. So his coupling was to a singlet, a D prime singlet like this. And where D prime, he took to be a linear combination of the D cosine Kabibo angle plus S times the sine of the Kabibo angle. I'm sorry, we're looking at the D. So he said, well, the state of the down that's relevant here is a linear combination of the D and the S, not just the D that occurs in this doublet. So there's some mixing between the down, eventually the strange, and the bottom quark. Now, once it's known that there is also a charm quark, this quickly gets generalized. Let's go with it here.
Let's
just go with it. once you know there's a charm part, you can treat this as a rotation. I think how this works. It's simpler to mix the masses. So Kabibo put some basically a correction into the interaction term in the covariance arithmetic. And it works, but it works equally well if you have an interaction term IG, you've got some psi bar, you've got some VI / tau I psi. What you're going to do is put some mixing matrix here, so you've got a cosine minus, it doesn't have to be that small, cosine theta c minus sine theta c sine theta c cos theta cabibo with the, let's see, so what's mixing here? I seem to have that in the wrong place. I'm mixing the wrong. So, yeah, what he put was like up, and he had d cos theta plus s sine theta. Not Weinberg, could be both. But equivalently, you can hit the Yukawa term. So here we have a phi dagger psi bar. We've got some coefficient here, and psi right left. So a Lagrangian that looks like that, you can put the mixing over in this term and leave this one the way it was, and you accomplish the same thing. This being diagonal means you're working in mass eigenstates. This being diagonalized means you're working in eigenstates of the weak interaction. And as long as the two of those are not the same, you're going to get mixing. So instead of this, we leave this part alone. So you just put psi here. But now, over here, you turn this G into a matrix. So you put psi dagger, you put the right guys, and you put a G, these are quark prime, psi L quark prime, psi right quark. So, sum on Q, Q prime. So you stick a matrix. If you rearrange your states to diagonalize this, then those are the mass eigenstates. But those mass eigenstates are not the same combination of fields that enter in over here. So you get the same effect. The still is going to decay, and so those different masses lead to just the kind of thing we were talking about with the neutrino oscillation. They have different masses, they can slosh back and forth. So this is the way that it ends up being done. There's probably maybe useful to have an additional constant out here. This matrix then is the Kobayashi-Moskawa matrix. So the KM matrix. All right. What happened historically was that Kobayashi and Moskawa, when the charm quark was discovered, they realized that you could do the Kabibo trick more systematically with a matrix here. And so that ended up being equivalent. So you put a 2x2 matrix in here that mixes the two doublets. So you have the up-down and you have the term strange doublet. And now you stick a mass matrix in there that shuffles those components so that they can all decay into one another. What was found by Fichte and Cronin was the P violation in the early 60s, I think it was. They got a Nobel Prize for that one, discovering CP violation. And if the CPT theorem holds, this is the one that implies time reversal invariance is violated in some processes. And let's see, that they discovered the asymmetry in the decay of the K long and K short, the chaos, the mesons we've seen. But CP violation doesn't follow from this kind of interaction. That takes a bit of detailed analysis, okay? So I won't run through that, but it's the paper by Kobayashi and Moskawa. A short paper, they point out that no matter what that matrix G is, there's not enough mixing going on to produce CP violation. Charge conjugation and parity non-conjugation combined symmetry is broken by these weak decays. And they observe that if you added a third set of quarks, so there would be enough degrees of freedom in a 3x3 matrix here to accomplish CP violation. You know, by tuning the parameters of the matrix to be the right thing, a 3x3 would be enough to allow CP violation. You can, you know, you get weird mixings and you can do it. That observation was essentially the prediction of the third family of quarks. So Kobayashi and Moskawa won the Nobel Prize for predicting the top-to-bottom quarks. It was from an analysis of the Cobebo mixing, but it had a lot to do with explaining CP violation and introducing a new family of quarks. And the Kobayashi-Moskawa matrix is now called the CKM, honoring all three, CKM matrix. So now, with this sum running over all three families of quarks, you can account for the masses of the quarks and all the decays we see. So the experimental, the components of this matrix are determined experimentally. It doesn't have to be a unitary matrix. It's in general not. It's just it's something that transforms with two copies of the SG3 matrix. So it's a tensor under, it's a Rankine tensor under SG3. And so you know how it transforms. But when you diagonalize it, you can write it as two matrices that you can then diagonalize both of and associate one with the right and one with the left. It's a principal component decomposition or something like that. And so you can assign masses to the right and left-handed members of the different families. And this solves the problem. So with the introduction of a few more parameters into the model, you account for the decay. Well, what we need is the same thing for the weak interaction. Now that it appears that neutrinos have mass, and the neutrinos can transmutate into one another, you need the same kind of a Yukawa term for the weak interaction. And then by putting, let's see, and that's called the Pontecorvo Maki Nakagawa Sakata matrix, of course, called P, M, and F matrix. It comes in the same way except for summing over the left arm. And this, I think, actually completes the picture. I'm not going to try and write down the whole Lagrangian now. I'll do that in the notes, and maybe I'll put it up on the board over the next couple of days sometime. and right out the full Lagrange. But let's put it in first. Does anybody have any questions on these mechanisms first?
Yeah. Does the CKM matrix, you're saying that maybe strains decayed up, but the strains ever decayed down? Is it, can they go to, can any quark decay to any other quark, at least any higher energy quark decay to any other?
Let me think. I'm trying to think whether they always change. So what's the isospin carried by the W plus and minus the xenon? That's really the question. So we're talking about weak decays. Let's see what the couplings are. So the xenons have the tau 3, and that's diagonal. Right. So the tau 3 is going to couple, say we have up and down and up bar, down bar here. But now, if this is mixed in with the D and S and B are mixed.
Well, you know, it's not just tau 3, it's tau 3 and the identity, right? Or.
Right. Yeah, that's right. So there's an identity part here. But it's diagonal, so it's not. Yeah, so that's not going to change the isospin. That's what I'm thinking here.
Okay.
Let's see. Yeah, this has an isospin number, but it's diagonal on isospin space. So.
I'm getting at this question because
yeah.
the subtle difference between the two matrices is that the CKM matrix switches between the part of the singlet that you're in, or that's what the weak decay usually does, right? Is it, you know, regular weak decay, you decay from down to up, right?
Yeah.
But with the leptons, you're decaying from the bottom to the bottom. Where does that come from? So if you're going from neutrino to neutrino, you're not switching up and down in the column.
So the xenon can do that, right? That's coupling the S to the C.
Okay.
Right. So that's all right. The one I'm puzzling about is how we would see that, you know, can a charm go to an up? You know, can we see that one? But I think it may happen in this matrix that Gazebo could have mixed the up and charm instead of the D and F, and this was a unitary transformation, so it could be on this psi, or it could have been over on the psi bar there, equally well. But by the time you couple it into the mass matrix here, right, that gives the same masses, but I think you can produce mixing between just about anything from a general mass matrix there. You really have the capability of factoring this into a couple of diagonal things on each of psi and psi bar. So I would bet that you could mix the up and charm as well as the down and strange there.
Okay.
And I'm seeing it explicitly. You know, it might be good for me to just sort of expand out the whole thing and see what happens. Be a good exercise. Finally, Sam. Yeah. Take this 20-term Lagrange and write all 100 terms. both of them do that. But, you know, it is instructive to take a piece of it, you know, and to take a couple of terms and expand it out and look at the details. maybe we'll have to do some of that. Somewhere. Yeah, in fact, I'm pretty sure it was one of these Wikipedia articles. I saw a diagram of the six quarks with the arrows and weights for what the probability of this quark decaying into that quark actually was.
Okay.
And I think it had arrows going just about everywhere. So there's some probability, though. It gets the probability for a top to go straight to another quark, I think, is maybe small. But I think there is a probability for that. I think it was a Fortman diagram, but I'm not sure if I'm remembering exactly. I've only just started looking at this stuff again after writing that paper.
Is this the seesaw mechanism?
Well, yeah. It is, except I looked that up this morning, but I didn't say yet. But I got to. Can you tell us anything about the seesaw mechanism?
No, all I know about it is that it was
related.
A hot topic.
It's related. What happens in the seesaw mechanism is, if you set some breaking scale for masses, so you get a particular number for the Higgs vacuum expectation value that they have. VEV is the vacuum expectation value. People in the business, they're just only talking about the VEV. It's shorter than saying all the syllables. You set that at a certain value. Well, what is it? Maybe, a TEV or something. And, 100 GEV is, it's a fairly substantial thing. But you get this symmetric combination between a certain mass state. And I'm not sure what we're talking about the masses of here. And this may particularly come into play nicely in supersymmetry. So that if some particle gets a mass that's substantially below the Higgs-Viv, there's some other particle that gets a mass reciprocally above the Higgs mass. So you have some relationship, like the mass of the Higgs squared is the the mass of one particle times the mass of the second particle. So if you make this one big, you're making that one small, and the geometric mean is the Higgs. So there's kind of a seesaw between the masses of these two particles. I'm sure that's what the seesaw is about, but I can't tell you which particles we're talking about here. It may happen in a grand unified model, where like the X and Y in the SU5, you want to give them really big masses because you don't see them. So you make them satisfy this seesaw relationship to some other low masses, say the W is at 90, and then there's some other particle that is reciprocally higher than the Higgs mass. But I know that once you've done this and given these things these different masses, you can get that seesaw effect going.
Is that a continuous thing, or is it very just a few discrete?
Values of the mass. No, I think it's a continuous thing. I mean, so far as that goes, the seesaw effect, I think you probably have just some relationship like this. That you get these pairs of particles, and I don't see exactly where it comes from. There is a factor of V in these Yukawa couplings, right? Because this is going to be replaced by the VEV, right? In the mass term, the Higgs here is going to acquire a vacuum expectation value, and so now this will become constant, and the rest of this looks like mass. So you square out this matrix, and you collect things into some diagonal basis, and it'll look like mass terms for the various plus or less on whichever way you're comparing. That's a good question. On the same page that they talk about these matrices, they're talking about the seesaw, but I didn't digest exactly what the relationship is there. Yeah. Look it up. Tell us about it. That's about all I know about it.
I know that it was thought for a while that that there were two massless flavors and one massive neutrino.
That could be, you know. Suppose you gave, say, the mu neutrino a small mass, then either the other two could turn into it, and so they could, at second order, turn into one another. That kind of process could happen, too.
And also that in the solar production, only one flavor was being produced. And subsequent mixing.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the electron neutrino is what you expect in the nuclear fusion, right? Because you're most likely to produce an electron rather than a mu or a tau, because the phase space is bigger, right? It's just a matter of the right. Remember, you integrate over all possible momenta, and the direction of these QED or weak interactions is driven by the number of final states. Well, the number of final states for a low mass particle is a lot higher than the number of final states possible for a high mass particle. And so the interaction, an interaction that takes that lets a neutron decay, a proton decay into a neutron by emitting a W plus, that W plus can decay then into either an electron-electron neutrino or tau and tau neutrino or muon-mu neutrino, but what's more likely? Well, the muon mass is 270 times the mass of the electron, and it probably comes in square, so the probability for electron production is much higher in the solar interaction. Yeah, and you can calculate these cross-sections. I mean, you've got the tools to do it. Take a few weeks, but you can calculate this. You know, it's the same kind of thing you've been doing in QED. You know, look at the decay of some particle. You know, first or second order diagram, and you know, it's a similar calculation to the ones we've been doing in QED. So, other questions? I don't have much more to say today. Ask questions, go home, whatever. Let's see. Friday. Your time is Friday. And you're talking about the path integral?
Path integral, right.
Okay. So path integral Friday. Do you have any questions on that before you... Or is that going along nicely? Or, you know, we can talk about it on Friday. But, you know, if you want to say anything about any questions, that's fine. Anything else?
As far as next week?
Yeah.
Have to be ready Wednesday or Friday to talk? Is that okay? Whichever one.
Sure. Nathan, are you looking at Monday? Or are you looking
at Monday? But ah. So Friday, whatever.
So you guys duke it out. anytime. Yeah, I might try to write up the Lagrangian, but, you know, I'm thinking that we're gradually going to, you know, we've got three talks over the last four classes, and you guys are probably playing busy around exams, so you don't need to make up some whole new thing to talk about. So I'm gradually shifting over to start to think about research stuff, and, you know, I'm going to be doing that for the next few months. I want to try and, you know, sort of put the whole Lagrangian together, and maybe I'll write it on the board, maybe I'll just leave it to the notes, but that's sort of what I wanted to cover, and I think we pretty much got it. We could list the terms. Should we list the terms that go in it? So, what is the final Lagrangian actually look like? Let's see what we can say about that. So, we've got some action. We've forgotten all our definitions. emissions, but we had a bunch of gauge fields. We had some we had F, G, and H, right? And everybody remember which was which?
I've got it.
Good. We might as well stick with what we said before. So what were the gluon? The gluon gauge field.
I think the gluon ones were fluid to do with
oh, the gauge field. What was the field strength, though? I'm just trying to get the field strength. I know we had an F and a G and an H, but...
Field for the gluons was F. Capital F.
Okay. And the index?
A. Little a.
Little a. So, A is going to run from 1 to 8 generators for SU3. Then, next one, probably G.
Yep.
And an I, maybe?
Yep.
And I is going to run over the 3 generators of SU2. And then we have the U1. So it's just a simple F, just one generator. So those are the kinetic terms and interactions for the gauge particle.
You call those capital H.
H.
Oh. Please decline.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
I went up and went back. Okay, yeah, F, G, and H is what we call them. Okay. Then we have, let's do the quark interaction. So for the quark, we have a sum over quark, phi bar for each quark. Then we have I C slash phi quark. But now, these ought to be left-handed quarks. So let's make these guys left-handed. And the mass terms, okay, we don't add the same mass term for each one because we're going to add masses for all of them. Anyway, this D involves all of the generators here. So this includes both the weak and the strong interaction. It's the one I wrote out first over there. I can explain this again if we get to that point. But there's that. Then we have some Yukawa couplings for the particles, for the quarks. We'll have a sum on Q prime, and then, let's see, what do we need? We have a Higgs in here. And then phi right bar to then our CKM matrix. With Q bar by Q prime left. So that gives masses to the quark. Then for the lepton sector, we have similar stuff. So we'll have a sum over lepton by lepton R I D slash by lepton. Let's see. Oh, sorry. We also have right stuff. We also have right, U bar I D slash to the right, but the right particles, the D slash is simpler because it won't have the weak coupling because these are singlets instead of right doublets. So this covariant derivative has the tau matrices in it that give weak interactions, but since these are singlets, those terms are absent from this covariant derivative. then we have a similar situation for the lepton. For the right-handed part of the lepton. If you write this out, what you do here is to put in exactly the terms you need. Now, and this is something else I want to work out in the notes, and I'll explain it. I need to put further explanation to it. But you need to add exactly the right stuff here, the right stuff here, to make the electromagnetic interaction conserve parity. So the whatever comes in here for the electromagnetic interaction is designed to just balance the electromagnetic part, the coupling to the photon here. So you'll have, in particular, you'll have right-handed photon couplings exactly matching. And then you have the mass terms here that will let us give neutrinos. Oops, not Q. L times. So same kind of thing here, different matrix. And this is the P, but Maki. The other one, and Zakata, PM.
PM and Nakagawa.
Nakagawa? Okay. Yeah, okay. The PMNF, LL prime, I double left, and L prime. So that gives masses to the different leptons. So these two terms give masses to the quarks and leptons that are different. And they're symmetry breaking, so they both involve the Higgs. If we're at high enough energy that the Higgs particles don't perturb around the vacuum excitation value, these just look like some couplings to some other particle. This is just some coupling between three particles. So the mass differences, they wouldn't be negligible. They'd still be present because of these matrices, but they have a different character at very high energy. And then we have the Higgs vector. So the Higgs is a doublet, so we need a fine dagger coupled to phi. Let's see, it was a straight square, right? It's the absolute magnitude. And then we have this potential for the Higgs that I think we were able to write as phi squared minus v squared quantity squared. Did we have an overall constant on that? Perhaps we did. But clearly this has this extrema plus minus v, so that establishes our symmetry breaking for the Higgs. Anything else? Are we missing anything? Okay, now, if we were to write out all components of everything, how many terms would there be? Should we play?
Space-time and...
Oh, not the space-time component. No, let's not get totally obscene about it. Okay, when we come over all parts, there's... On the Clark terms, there is another sum over color. So all of these Clark terms are summed over red, blue, and green. Right. So that triples the number of terms that you're actually seeing there. Then each of these fields is what? It's a doublet. Right. So this term is going to include the up and the down, right? So for Q equals U, we've got the up, down here. So if you square all that out with each of the different poly matrices in there, let's see, that, I don't know how many terms that turns in. You know, it turns into at least four terms, right? If you, you know, if you've got the two component spinner here, four component spinners. You have two spinner fields here, two spinner fields there, so you'll get a sum of four terms from that. This covariant derivative Right, you've got the usual kinetic term that's got a partial derivative. Then you've got the strong and the SE2 and the U1 coupling. So there are actually four terms in each of these covariant derivatives. So 4 times 4, that's 16 terms there, some 3 times. So that's 48 terms. Right. Now, without writing out the components of the spinners, right? That's 48 Dirac kinetic terms, or Dirac.
So 48 times 3. Yeah.
Times the 4 combustion. Yeah. Oh, so okay. Then there are more. yeah, similar argument here. This is a 3x3 matrix. So, that's 9 terms, if you multiply all that out. This is 2, but of course it's going to reduce to 1 eventually. These are still, this is sum over families, really, right? Because we want to give each part a little bit different mass. So here we're summing over families. Let's see, meanwhile, what has happened to the doublet? Let's see, the doublets are actually contracted in the Higgs, right? And this is a doublet, and that side left is a doublet. So those two are 4 terms, and then each of those 4 terms gives us 9s, maybe 36 terms. I'm guessing a little bit there.
The very first term in the pattern, that has 9 terms.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because, all right, remember F, for the non-abelian field, F is the curl of the gauge field, if you want to count that as 2 terms. Let's just count that as 1 term. So,
okay.
Right, so an F A mu nu is P mu of our gluon field, G A nu minus D mu G. Let's count this as 1 term, because we're used to thinking of that as the kinetic term. Plus a structure constant with a pair of fluons, G, B, U, G, C, nu. So when you form this contraction, you're squaring this thing, so you get 4 terms from that. There's also a sum over all 8 gluons. So that's 32 terms for this one. Here you've got a sum of 3 times those 4, 12 terms here, and one lonesome term there. That's abelian. So just the usual electromagnetic light thing here.
Right.
Not again, but just an F squared. So makes the NM look really simple, but of course we're just trying to describe everything at once. So it's mouthful. let's see, what else do we have? The lepton, the story here, we don't have the sum over colors, so it's not all times. But you have similar large numbers of terms here. The Higgs, this is like 4 terms. When we expanded phi around the vacuum expectation value, this quadratic potential looks pretty ugly. Right? For the rho, remember we wrote phi is the vacuum expectation plus some field rho, and so the nu just gives us some constants, but you're taking that stupid thing to the fourth power, so that's as ugly as you could ever wish for. So, certainly not the way to think about it. You think about it term by term. What is each term doing? And I think we've gone through and understood that pretty well. You might have written this 30 years ago, in much the same way. Undoubtedly, since then, there are a lot of refinements on this. Joe showed us a couple of the things that could be added that might be carried. So, these quadratic terms are not the only thing you could write here. You could also put something like F A mu nu, F A alpha beta, epsilon mu nu alpha beta. You could put a term like that. And that's a possible additional set of gluon couplings. How do you know whether there is a term like that there or not? And you make some predictions from the whole thing, and you see what happens at CERN or Fermilab, and whether the actual interactions you see do look like that. And you put some limits on the coefficients of things. So it's possible that there could be something like that. You guys look at the particle data group? You go and crawl through those pages? Fun stuff. Fun stuff. That's a lot of data to understand. Does this model predict all those branching ratios? There are a lot of ways, given this, that a given particle can decay. If it's not forbidden, it happens. So, everything that can happen will. Okay. Back to question. Anything I should bring out some more here?
What is the range right there?
On the order of 20. Let's count. We've got a strong coupling, an NG2, and a U1 coupling. So there are three coupling constants in the covariant derivative. That's three. That's G strong and G and G prime. Then here, this matrix, we've got 9 plus 9, let's call it 9 for the Kabibo Moskawa,
CKM,
Kobayashi Moskawa matrix. That's 9 parameters, that's a 9 there. That's G prime. We have 9 for the CMNS, that's all prime. So 18, 19, 20, 21. We've got a maximum expectation value for the Higgs. One for the Higgs. G. Any other parameters in that? So maybe 22 parameters. That seems to be about the right number, 21, 22 parameters. It seems to me that's the number I've heard. So, I think. What's that?
I thought they were 19.
There are some constraints on these, so we may be overcounting a little here. It's possible there are only like 5 parameters in this. Let me think. Anybody see any more parameters?
Constants
and power potential. This is going to have a coefficient. If you start adding other terms, you're going to introduce some parameters, but not that many. Certainly on the order of 20 for the standard model is the right answer. Give or take, depending on what we've forgotten. And I think there are some constraints on these. That's the reason that Kobayashi and Moskawa were able to say, well, with two families, you don't have enough parameters to get CP violations. The number of free parameters, I'm pretty sure, is less than the full 9. There are some constraints on that. It's not that it's unitary, but there's something constraining it. I don't recall what. Let's see, mixing angles. Yeah, there's the Weinberg angle. Okay, yeah. So, yeah, mixing angles, okay. Well, the Kibibo is taken into those entropies, but we do have the Weinberg mixing angle for the left-right asymmetry, the parity violation. I think the CP violation is built into the mixing matrices. So most of the parameters are those mass matrices. You know, mass is the signature, right? You can, there are predictions of masses, you know, for the composite particles. So for the baryons, you can look at the constituent particles and say, oh, well, they, you know, the quarks couple like this. And so we predicted the mass of the proton is such and such, and it comes out pretty close. So you can predict the masses of the composite particles from the dynamics and masses of the quarks. Those models then also, in the course of finding the best fit for the models, gives you predictions of quark masses too. So those come out of the analysis of the fractal quantities. But what gives the quarks themselves those masses? I don't know that there's any theory underlying that. There are limits on the mass of things. Like the mass of a charged particle can't be less than its electrostatic energy. So, you know, or so that kind of constraint on masses. When you look at the neutron and proton masses, you can actually understand the difference between the neutron and proton masses in terms of the relative, in terms of the charges of the constituent quarks. Now, there's more charge in the proton, and that gives us a slightly different mass. So, other questions? So, when you guys are ready to talk about your topics, we'll talk about your topics. And, you know, come with any questions. If you're still working on the Compton thing, you know, we can, you know, get some of that up on the board. You know, this is, this is probably a good spot to generally stop the day. From here on, it's, you know, whatever you guys want to bring to it, we'll discuss. Yeah. It's been fun. I really enjoyed digging into this. It's been nice to revisit the standard model. We haven't talked back here. If any of you see any, you know, problems in the notes, you know, pop me a note about it. I'll fix up the notes. They're pretty current. I was just writing up a little bit more about these math matrices, and I'll post the final version. But as of the 20th, the section on FP3 flavor is all I plan to write on it. Much of any corrections you get. Thanks all.
Thank you. What a ride.
I don't have many that I want to have actually.
I've got a few some photos of when you were gone the other day.
Okay.
It was great lecture. The April boy. So you might want to get those for me. I'll put them on a zip and
mostly like pictures or something.
Yeah, they're not high resolution or anything. I shot them with my phone.
Or so the files you're looking for are the ones.
Yeah, anything like you.
Oh, okay. I don't know how big it is. Everything from last semester, I just clumped together. Yeah. Color one, quantum filter. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh wow.
Well,
if you have a large
flash drive or something.
Yeah, I do. I guess 4 gigs that would fit it right. I hope 4 gigs.
Can
we plan to do that next time around?
Okay.
Yeah. I'll bring the zip, and if we have to do a couple different.
I can try something else. Yeah, make it faster.
So that's the stress energy sensor.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, you've got all those field squared minus.
Newton,
Newton squared. Right. Yeah. That's right. The source for gravity looks pretty much like all of that. With a couple extra indices. Let's see. The covariant derivatives, of course, are going to be covariant with respect to gravity. So you've got a Christoffel connection in all of those covariant derivatives.
As well.
Yeah. As well as everything else. The Dirac kinetic terms, those need to be covariant derivatives. So where we had a partial, those would be curved space covariant. That's fairly ugly. The gamma matrices are going to be a solder form times the flat space gamma matrix. So you define your gamma matrices in flat space, and then you put an EAU on them, an inverse solder form.
Just
a
coefficient.
Yeah, right.
Solder form is EAU.
Yeah.
So you have a
gamma mu that's really an EAU on a flat space gamma A.
Okay.
So you have other couplings to the metric in those. There's a lot of metric couplings in that. Right. Right, a closed form solution.
Where's your camera?
That's green in the room.
My flashlight.
You have a couple
minutes? You look better than
what?
Mine.
You have a couple minutes?
Yeah, sure.
When it puts the backspace actually. Yeah, it's like P, and then I see the symbol, that symbol, and I put the flash on there. What is the flash over here?
I don't know why it shows up.
It turns from the rebellion.
Oh, okay.
Does it show when you do
it?
Yeah.
It is D alpha.
Oh, okay. Cross-section in this homework again.
Yeah. day to day out.
Yep.
So we can interchange news and thickness. We got the data out there.
Copy on my desk. I haven't really looked into this stuff. Yeah, it's just sitting there.
Another term like that, just an alpha beta search.
Almost. Okay.
And,
this off.
Sometimes driving it in terms of finish helps.
Got some money.
which now for holding X fit as we do this. So X is just a parameter. Then F and A are independent now. It's just some linear combination of the A. So some Y dependent linear combination of the Y. So if we, call, A of mu is some A mu. Y, think of that as some sort of transformation. So, let's just name it W, so it's more like a coordinate. So then this F is some function of W, dW. So that's some one form of data mu. So W. We're going to integrate that thing along curves to get as far as we need to. And the integrability condition says that that's independent of half. Now, let me take a trip. So, D of that thing. D of this A of mu is 0. Well, let me get it out. But so the data is a one form, so you get basically some curl free vector. So again, almost a geometric statement. Let's see.
Yeah. Let's put it back here, we put it just to F as D of A.
Yeah, but that's D in an X space, in the X space. So,
okay.
Yeah, so what? So if we change our coordinates,